Why, hello, dear runner. I dare say I'm pleased to see you've decided to take an historic running tour in support of the Roberson Museum and Science Center. Your contributions help support fun learning experiences like this one. So thank you. I'm Nat, and I'll be the voice in your ear as we run through 10 local stories and hidden gems of this great city, known by many names. The Parlor City, the Valley of Opportunity, but most of us here just call it home. While you're on the run, please be sure to stay safe and watch when you're crossing the street. You can stop and listen to the story at the locations we guide you to, or you can glance and notice as you run past and absorb the information on the go. And if you're elsewhere running along with this, enjoy the stories we have in store. Without further ado, we begin outside the Roberson Mansion. So ready, set, go! We begin our running tour at Roberson Mansion. This magnificent home was completed in 1907 for Alonzo and Margaret Roberson. At this point in history, Binghamton was turning into a bustling city of industry. No longer a village on the wild frontier of upstate New York, it had become tamed and civilized, to use terminology of the time. It had become colonized and repurposed to suit the Western ideal of society. And this mansion, with its paletted windows and Renaissance Revival-style architecture, was built to be the ideal of high society, to equal the extravagance of its neighbors. Yes, it dwarfs in comparison to some of the McMansions in America today, but in its time, it was magnificent. Gilded Age extravagance once lined the whole of Front Street, one of a few select blocks where Binghamton's elites gathered, where new wealth and influencers were converging. And Margaret and Alonzo Roberson made quite an impression when they decided to move into the neighborhood. Before this historic home was built, there were two houses already on the property. The Robersons paid for both, leveled them, and then built their own home on the property, reshaping the landscape to their ideal. A showcase of wealth and status. After all, our homes are very much a reflection of ourselves. While it was being built, the Robersons and their home were indeed seen by their neighbors and the Binghamton community at large through local newspaper articles. It wasn't that Alonzo and Margaret needed more space. Their former home on Main Street would have done quite nicely for a married couple in their 40s with no children on the horizon. But Front Street offered more proximity to certain people like the Davidges, the Roses, and the Kilmers. It was built with 26 rooms, central heat, an elevator, ballroom, servants' quarters, and the features go on. When hearing about this mansion, and maybe looking upon it, ask yourself about your own home and what it conveys to visitors when you're able to have them over. And then ask yourself what the Robersons might be trying to impress upon their own visitors with this home. Our next bit of history starts on the other side of the Shenango River on the corner of State Street. Before this was State Street, this road was a waterway. The Shenango Canal bisected downtown Binghamton and helped put this town on the map. It was completed in 1837 and connected Binghamton to the Erie Canal up in Utica. Binghamton's Shenango Canal was a hefty investment, a real gamble for a small village to make, but it paid off. And just 30 years later, Binghamton's population was bursting, and this village, sitting in New York's frontier, became incorporated as a city. This year, it actually celebrated 154 years as a city. Happy birthday! Its industry previously based in agriculture, was now becoming a space where luxury goods were manufactured and assembled. The area was developing from a vast outland in the countryside into a place of commerce and society. Binghamton became known then as the Valley of Opportunity for the wealth of job opportunities it promised immigrants who began flocking to the factories. And fun fact, Binghamton at one point became the second largest manufacturer of cigars. After New York City, of course, it's difficult to beat out a city that supposedly never sleeps. In 1878, the canal was filled in, like many have been since, and became present-day State Street that you're running along right now. Trains were becoming the new mode of getting around faster and closing the distance between us. And then trains had to make way for cars and highways. Beep, beep. There's always something better ahead, I suppose. Our next stop is another stately home on Court Street named Phelps Mansion. This street once held a court of extravagant homes for Binghamton's elite, much like Front Street did. The last holdout to this new wave of urban development is, of course, Phelps Mansion. The beginnings of Roberson Mansion very much mirror how this Victorian home began. Three properties, all with existing homes on them, were purchased by Sherman David Phelps, demolished, and a new, more extravagant structure was erected in its place in 1871. It was built with three floors in the Empire style, which means it has a Munster family Bates mansion kind of feeling. It has all the vibes of a Gothic story about to unfold, but don't worry, there aren't any bodies kept in this historic home, as far as we're aware. Sherman Phelps was a banker and a businessman. He went by Judge Phelps, though he never presided over a courtroom, though perhaps he felt he presided over his Court Street neighborhood. It does feel a little on the nose, though, but who knows. He also did hold office of the Mayor of Binghamton. Very fancy. But before Phelps Mansion would become a museum, it passed through the Phelps family. Sherman's grown children occupied the grounds for a time, and then when no one in the Phelps family wanted it, it passed through various hands, including a shoe manufacturer and postmaster. Keep in mind, an estate like this takes many hands to maintain. Roberson Mansion had a small business's worth of staff taking care of the grounds, and still kind of does today. Phelps, too, must have required a similar number to assist in its care. And there are not many in America or Binghamton who have the funds to keep up with the needs of homes such as these. And they are quite needy. In 1905, the home passed to the Monday Afternoon Club, a women's group who organized suffrage rallies pushing for the women's right to vote in Binghamton, in New York State, and across America. Before becoming a historic house museum, the ladies of this house made their own touch-ups to the home in the form of more vibrant wallpaper and lifestyle upgrades. If you do go for a tour at the Phelps Mansion, try to spot the differences of Gilded Age versus Monday Afternoon Club. It's a fun game. But this home does make one wonder what will become of the mansions of the 21st century. Will they too become offices and apartments? Who knows? Our next stop will be the Marconi Tower and Lackawanna train station near the NYSEG baseball stadium. Right next to the once bustling Lackawanna train station sits an aged 97-foot steel tower. Its historic plaque only gives passerbys a taste of what this tower signifies and the man who helped erect it. This tower played a significant role in pushing the boundaries of wireless technology. There's a phrase used among today's tech giants, move fast and break things, a motto and mindset pushed by Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Well, think of this tower as a piece of history from the Victorian version of Silicon Valley. And Guglielmo Marconi was the man who was disrupting the field of wireless communication. Not to mention, this Italian-born inventor was in a major way bursting the British tech bubble. The UK at the time thought they had a monopoly on innovating the future. So yes, there was enough drama to fill a TV series when he came in with a working wireless communication system that would, in time, connect nations separated by an ocean in an instant. In fact, many more lives may have been lost in the Titanic tragedy had it not been for his wireless technology. It was really a bit of luck, if you could call it that, amidst this huge catastrophe. The story goes that a radio operator on another ship that was equipped with Marconi's technology in the Atlantic was supposed to turn in just minutes before the distress call went out. And the operator was able to respond to the call and save more people who may have otherwise perished from exposure. In 1913, this tower that we're standing in front of was erected as the next test of Marconi's magnificent invention. He had sent a transatlantic signal, and now he needed to find out if his wireless signal was fast enough to keep up with a moving train. If telegraphic messages could be transmitted from a station to locomotives across the Lackawanna line. There was a growing need to communicate with fast-moving trains on tight schedules, but at the time, it was doubtful that it could be done. Transmitting to a slow-moving ship, like the Titanic, with a high antenna over an unobscured span of water was one thing. Transmitting to a high-speed train with a low antenna through mountains, trees, and buildings posed a more complicated challenge. But on April 15th, 1914, history was made. Communication with a moving train was accomplished. It was an exciting moment, but it was short-lived. It turns out the broadcast frequency they were using to transmit the signal from the railroad was the same as the U.S. Navy. And the railway transmissions had blocked critical military communications. Oops. A different frequency would have to be tried. But here remains a piece of Marconi history and his wireless technology that continued to close the vast distances between us. Our next stop is just a short hop and skip to the corner, the one and only Remlex. Okay, so there's a lot of interesting history on this corner, but I have to point out one more. Remlex Restaurant and Oyster Bar. Lunch plans, anyone? And did you know Remlex in the reverse spells Kilmer? Mind-blowing, I know. Anyway, back in the day, this building once produced the infamous Dr. Kilmer's Swamp Root, Kidney Liver, and Bladder Remedy. Apparently, people had a lot of issues going on with their lower functions, which made Kilmer a wealthy man. If you look up every once in a while during your run, you will notice a lot of the older buildings downtown carry the Kilmer name, etched in stone. Kilmer's Swamp Root was a household name in America in the early 1900s. And when you're a household name, you can build a lot of fabulous buildings and also buy a newspaper and a champion racehorse named Exterminator, and you get the idea. The extent of their wealth and power was documented in a 1912 story published in Collier's magazine. Two Kilmers, father and son, Jonas M. and Willis Sharp, manufacture and vend swamp root. It is today the leading industry of the lively and progressive little city where it is made, Binghamton, New York. The fortune derived from it is variously estimated at from 10 to 15 millions, all accumulated in the last 20 years. The Kilmer House is the most expensive in Binghamton, The two Kilmer buildings are the finest business blocks in the city, with no exception. The Kilmer's newspaper, the Binghamton Press, has the largest circulation in that part of the state. The People's Bank, Jonas Kilmer president, Willis Sharp Kilmer vice president, is a strong and growing institution. Jonas Kilmer has been police commissioner of the city. Willis Kilmer has congressional aspirations in every phase of existence in Binghamton, except perhaps in the social phase. The Kilmers are powerful and feared. The foundation of this wealth and power, of course, was built on fraud. It was a swamp root remedy that cured nothing. All it was selling was the illusion of health and wellness. As with today, how many sell this illusion of quick fixes and well-being? Our next story will be down the block at the Greyhound bus station. You unlock the store with the key of imagination. Beyond it, another dimension. You've come to a place that maintains the facade from when it was built 100 years ago, but looks as if a day has not passed. This streamlined modern bus station, a mirror image of the past. It wouldn't be an historic walking tour if I didn't mention Rod Serling, Binghamton's golden boy, and a revolutionary mind in television, so please excuse the impression. As alluded to in my introduction of this place, this Greyhound bus station appeared in the episode called Mirror Image, and if you watch that episode next to this bus station, it's like this building hasn't aged a day. Eerie. Well, more like historical preservation efforts. Anyway, our next stop is just down Shenango Street, the Strand, right across from Alexander's Cafe. It's okay if it took a moment to notice the old Strand Theater. This building sits in the middle of Shenango Street, and it was once a monument to the moving arts in this city, only for its opulence to be slowly stripped away over the years. The only marker to what it was is laid in brick on its ornate parapets with one word, Strand. But you should have seen it. Opening night, March 1920, when hundreds of people lined up around this block, waiting to get a seat. Its glowing marquee lit the block against the title attraction, a silent picture, The Little Shepherd of Kingdom Come. After grabbing a ticket in the booth, shoes clicking against the handsomely decorated tile flooring, sound bouncing off the marble wainscoting to echo the magnificence of this place. The words, spared no expense, come to mind. It was a monument to the growing wealth under Binghamton's expanding industry. A city living in its golden years, having not yet reached its apex of success. But for now, it could spend its excess and give to the enlightenment of the arts. The silent movie played out a coming-of-age story of a man learning to grow up in the battlefields of the Civil War and coming home to see the world changed. Attendees watched in their plush seats as the lights dimmed at the closing scene to enjoy lighter fare, a vaudeville act in a concert, all for 18 cents. It survived through the Depression and saw growth in industry from the war, and it looked like the good times would never leave the Valley of Opportunity. But the suburban sprawl was redefining the landscape, and suddenly shopping centers were carrying films, malls were providing it all. An urban renewal began to ravage the old. The Strand was struggling to survive, its standards changing to serve a different audience, who consumed B-movies and X-rated films. It went out with quite a bang, though. During a premiere showing of Deep Throat in 1972, where officers busted down to raid the porn peddlers, gaining the theater one final moment in the spotlight as a national headline, taking its final bow as a theater. There's a lot that happened here at the Broome County Courthouse. It's the center of where rights are upheld or turned down, where people are deemed innocent or guilty. Hundreds of thousands of pieces of local history have passed through here. But point your head skyward for a moment to the green woman that stands holding scales and sword, a familiar symbol of the justice system. But there's something very different about our statue. She has gazed upon the city since 1897. Our Lady Justice has eyes that are not blindfolded, subverting the common depiction of blind justice. This statue of Lady Justice has been credited to the architect of the courthouse, Isaac G. Perry. Side note, Perry is responsible for the New York State Inebriate Asylum on the east side of Binghamton and the million-dollar staircase in the New York State Capitol building in Albany. Perry has many fine credentials under his name. However, he was likely not the artist behind this statue. We actually don't know for certain who the artist of this statue was. And without that, we can only begin to wonder if and what the creator's intention was of a Lady Justice that could see. Our next stop will be the Martin Luther King Jr. statue along the Riverwalk. We would be remiss to not include the 7-foot bronze statue of Martin Luther King Jr. It's a centerpiece of the Riverwalk here in downtown Binghamton. It has become a beacon where marches begin, where people gather to be heard and to listen, and a reminder of how far we've come and how far we've yet to go. This statue's journey to the Riverwalk has been long, stretching back decades to the 1980s. Following King's assassination, some communities across the United States wanted to preserve his legacy and name in history. Some things, especially Black and Brown history, have a tendency to get lost or reworked. But a few people in Binghamton sought a way to concretize him into their everyday lives, to not forget his impact. So in 1985, an MLK commission put forth a request to the Binghamton Council to rename the Court Street Bridge the Martin Luther King Jr. Bridge, as a gesture of King's ability to bridge the divide. However, it was struck down by a Binghamton council in a 5-3 vote. Varying reasons were given for rejecting the gesture. Some thought the renaming was too easy to ignore, and others gave more unfortunate, flimsy excuses. But the MLK Commission did not stop. For the next few decades, they worked to raise money and attention to erect a statue. And in November of 2010, the local MLK Commission accomplished what so many intended to do for so long. Claudia Clark, chairwoman of the MLK Commission, explained the statue's journey best. Quote, "It took all kinds of people to get this statue erected, and it's going to take all kinds of people to fully realize Dr. King's dream." Unquote. Our next story takes place along the Riverwalk as we head back towards Front Street. As you walk or run along this pathway that hugs the curves of the Susquehanna, you may be able to squint between the trees to see the museum. Yes, the end is in sight. But before the Robersons ever carved out this land for their home, and before the settlers came here before them, this shore was occupied by people who did and still do reside here. I'm talking about the Haudenosaunee. This is the ancestral land of the Onondaga Nation, which is one of six nations who make up the larger Haudenosaunee Confederacy. You may know the Confederacy by another name, Iroquois, which is considered a colonized name. Scholars can place the beginnings of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy as early as 1142, though some believe its formation took place much earlier than that. Its territory once stretched throughout present-day New York and Pennsylvania. Net sinkers, arrowheads, and stoneware have been found along these shores, traces of what was once a home for many, left behind. It was along these connecting rivers that the infamous Clinton-Sullivan assault used the waterways to move a rampage across its shores to push indigenous peoples from the land. These were General George Washington's orders to General John Sullivan in 1779. The expedition you are appointed to command is to be directed against the hostile tribes of the Six Nations of Indians, with their associates and adherents. The immediate objects are the total destruction and devastation of their settlements, and the capture of as many prisoners of every age and sex as possible. It will be essential to ruin their crops now, in the ground, and prevent their planting more. This describes a scorched earth campaign. People from 43 villages fled from their homes, leaving behind those bits of stoneware and belongings that are still uncovered when we dig deep enough today. Many died from this pointed assault, and many more people would have died of starvation had it not been for the emergence of a small creature, the cicada. Their brood unearthed themselves a swarming feast on wings and an excellent source of protein, fat, and nutrients. This year actually marks the emergence of Cicada Brood X. So when you hear the hum of the swarm as they come out to breed in their mass, keep in mind this is an important time for remembrance among the Onondaga. It was the cicadas that saved their ancestors' lives as they escaped. So it's here we remind ourselves of the history of this land and its significance to the Haudenosaunee, who are its past, present, and future stewards. All right, we're going to make our way back to the parking lot of the Roberson Museum and Science Center. As we conclude our journey together, we do hope this running tour has left you with a new perspective on Binghamton and its spaces, and that you'll take advantage of your free admission pass with your purchase of this tour to explore the wonders within Roberson Museum and to discover new things about this amazing city. But I want to leave you with a very heartfelt thank you for joining us, and hopefully we can take a tour together soon. Bye.